This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Employers are saying there are a ton of job openings that are going unfilled today because there's a lack of people willing to work. But a lot of those same employers are automatically disqualifying a massive pool of talent without even allowing them to apply for their positions. These are experienced, talented, and currently unemployed people who do not have a college degree. A recent editorial in the Washington Post called this degree discrimination. That editorial was written by the CEO of Opportunity at Work, a nonprofit that serves a group of workers they call STARS. That stands for people who are skilled through alternative routes. Here to talk about this provocative topic is Rebecca Gaiman. She's Director of Communications at Opportunity at Work. I asked her to talk about this op-ed and degree discrimination.
Before we can even talk about degree discrimination, I think we first should just talk about the math and the numbers. And here are the latest numbers, Bob. More than 60% of US active workers do not have a bachelor's degree. And yet a majority of employers in America require a bachelor's degree. So really what's happening and what we're seeing on the ground is that workers who do not have that bachelor's degree are being systematically screened out when employers put three simple words on a job listing, and those three simple words are bachelor's degree required. So really the inspiration for this piece by our CEO, Byron Auguste, was that he was reflecting back on the story of his father and how his father launched into the middle class. And he recalls that his father was working in a factory. He didn't have a bachelor's degree, but he saw an ad to train and learn new skills. And employers then granted him that privilege to go and use his skills, apply them to an entirely new career. And what's really sad is that that was 50 years ago. And as a Black man, he faced less discrimination then than he would have today. Today, he would have been completely screened out simply because he doesn't have that bachelor's degree. So that's what we're talking about when we're saying degree discrimination, is that employers are not even giving the majority of the American workforce a chance to even prove their skills. They're simply overlooked because they don't have that piece of paper.
And right now we hear that there is a worker shortage, that there's not enough people out there for the jobs that are open. Is this just making the problem worse?
Bob, that's absolutely right. And in fact, I used to be one of those people working with employers, consulting them on how to find the best talent, how to find the best workers. And I kept hearing over and over across the nation from employers, I can't find the talent I need. And you can imagine when the pandemic just started and we started to see these mass layoffs, I kept hearing that. And that really infuriated me, because if you're just a normal person, you're seeing that people are being laid off and saying, I'm applying to thousands of jobs and I'm getting nowhere. So I knew something was wrong. Something wasn't adding up. There's a hypocrisy in that employers are saying they need workers, while workers are saying, I can't even get through the door. So we think that removing this college degree requirement is a really momentous but simple way that employers can unlock a labor force of millions of people who are ready to work and who want to work, but are being screened out.
How would this make the culture of companies have to change? I mean, right now, HR directors aren't really the screeners anymore. Algorithms are.
That's a great point, Bob. And that's exactly when we started to see degree discrimination rise, was really in the last recession. It also happened to be the same time that online job platforms were taking off. So we're not saying in any way employers are evil. Employers were just trying to find a solution. And that solution was to say, okay, well, a college degree signals you might have some ability, tenacity, resourcefulness to go through and work through a degree. So let's use that. And then that will tell us what talent really has. What was wrong with that, though, is that college is not the only source for skills. In fact, it's not the only source for skills for the majority of Americans. But what ended up being a simple solution ended up really turning into this nightmare for millions of Americans. But all that to say, Bob, HR managers they do play a role. And it's not just them, it's actually the hiring managers. So who these people will actually serve on the teams of. And having been on hiring teams before, I can tell you, I have heard some pretty seemingly harmless things that are actually doing great harm to people. And just one example, I remember going through resumes for an internship position at another company, and someone in the room said, well, gosh, none of these folks are from great schools. So not only are we putting pressure to say, have the degree, we're also putting pressure on, well, what's a good school and what's not a good school? And it's just absolutely ridiculous to think that a school is the only signal to tell you what talent can actually do. There's so many other ways that people earn skills. I'm sure, Bob, there's a lot of skills you learned even in broadcasting that you didn't necessarily learn from school. I know I learned skills on how to do my job outside of the classroom. So why would we expect that from other people?
One of the points that Byron makes in his op-ed is that requiring a medical degree to treat patients or a civil engineering degree to build bridges, that's common sense. And you know, law school isn't going away either. But requiring some generic college degree to be considered for jobs such as office manager, sales rep, marketing, it just makes no sense.
It makes zero sense. And what's really sad is that we're seeing jobs just like those, like for example, administrative assistants. We're seeing that even those jobs are requiring a bachelor's degree now where they didn't used to before. There's just this huge, huge overuse of bachelor's degree required. And what it really translates to is that even if you have experience on the job learning, you've been in that job for years, if you try to leave, good luck. Because a lot of the same jobs are now requiring degrees where they didn't before.
So what's the solution? Is there anyone out there who's doing this a different way?
That's a great question. And I think what's promising is that we are seeing employers starting to wake up and realize that, wow, if we want talent with skills, if we want talent that's diverse, that's innovative, that's hardworking, we can't only be looking at this minority population of Americans with degrees. We have to open it to everyone. So we are seeing companies like IBM, for example, launch new initiatives that are opening up pathways to workers who don't have that traditional bachelor's degree. Even big companies like Google, Facebook, they're coming to the table, removing degree requirements. And really, that's our mission at Opportunity Day at Work, is to make it easier for employers to hire workers who are skilled through alternative routes, who are those stars. And we actually have a tech platform that's a one-stop shop for an employer to find these stars through training providers, through credential programs. And that's really half the battle, is that first and foremost, we have to change the mindset that yes, workers, even without a degree, have skills. But once we change the mindset, we need to then give employers actually the tools to go out there and proactively find, recruit, and source stars, workers who have those skills through alternative routes.
And finally, and I just want to point one thing out here, is that we are a show about education issues, and we are certainly not saying that there is no value to a college degree.
All right. And well, I'll be the first to say I'm married to a PhD, so I know academics for sure. But I think an important thing to remember in this case against degree discrimination is that we are not against college. In fact, we're for college. And a lot of workers who are skilled through alternative routes want to go back to college. And we support that. We are all for learning. We all have new skills to learn. But something that our CEO says that I think is so true is that college is a terrific bridge to opportunity, but it cannot be a drawbridge that gets let down just because someone doesn't have the time or the money to really go and get that four-year degree. We shouldn't say, oh, the only way to get successful in this country is to spend thousands of dollars and have the luck and circumstance to do it.
Rebecca Gaiman is the Director of Communications at Opportunity at Work. You can learn more at opportunityatwork.org. Still to come, one of the largest and most unique state parks in the country has an interesting history. We'll learn a bit about it next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The Adirondack Park is a unique combination of public and private land in the northeast corner of New York State. The park is 9,300 square miles and has about 130,000 permanent residents. The Adirondack Park Agency is the regulatory body overseeing the park, and it turns 50 years old this year. Its formation was controversial. A new book called A Wild Idea, How the Environmental Movement Tamed the Adirondacks, traces the evolution of the agency and the people involved in its creation. The Best of Our Knowledge's Pat Bradley spoke with the book's author, Brad Edmondson, about why the creation of the Adirondack Park Agency was a wild idea.
It was a wild idea because nobody had ever tried it before. There were two things that were really out there for their time, and they're actually still pretty radical. One was the state of New York assumed zoning control over 6 million acres of land. Usually zoning is a town and village responsibility, but the state of New York decided that the towns and villages of the Adirondacks couldn't handle the challenges that the park was facing. So they basically assumed control over an area the size of Vermont. And as you might imagine, the towns and villages didn't like that one bit. So that was pretty wild. And then the other thing was that the ideas that were driving the land use plan that the state drafted were new at the time. It was essentially the environmental impact statement, which is everybody kind of knows what that is now, and that's a standard part of any application process. But in 1971, people hadn't really had very much experience with environmental impact statements. It was kind of a proof of concept for that over a huge area. So it was a very, very ambitious thing to do.
What drew you to take a look at the formation of the Adirondack Park Agency 50 years ago?
Well, initially, it wasn't going to be a book. I was approached by a friend who was involved with the formation of the park agency 18 years ago, who gave me a little bit of support and paid my expenses to go do oral history interviews with some of the people who had set up the park agency. And I thought, this is cool. This is going to be a way to get my expenses paid to go camping in the Adirondacks and have some interesting conversations. But land use planning is really kind of dull, you know, so this is just a good gig. I was a freelance writer. I started off with Clarence Petty. Anybody who's met Clarence is immediately hooked on the Adirondacks. He was a terrific storyteller. And I spent 10 hours of taping him. And by the time I was finished with him, I was completely absorbed in the story. And the deeper I got into it, the more interesting it got. This is anything but a boring story. There's a tremendous amount of drama in it because it really is about the clash of values on a very deep level. And that is continuing today.
Brad Edmondson, you mentioned Clarence Petty, but you ended up talking to more than 50 people who were involved in some way in establishing the Adirondack Park Agency. How did you end up getting a hold of them and getting them to agree to talk about their experience? Because it's not just people who were for the formation of the Adirondack Park Agency. It's also some people that were adamantly against this whole idea.
That's a great question, and the answer was surprising to me. I was funded by someone who had been the Atlantic chapter president of the Sierra Club. And he wanted me to capture the stories of the environmental movement, which I did. But as I got more involved in it, I got more and more interested in the opposition to the Adirondack Park Agency because I felt like the people who were fighting the agency really had some legitimate points. But I was concerned that they would sort of brand me as an enemy. And what I found actually was that if you just show up and say you're interested in hearing someone's story and you don't really telegraph any other intention than listening, people are eager to talk. And the Adirondacks is really a very small town. Everybody knows everybody else. What I found was that a lot of the hardcore environmental people I spoke with actually knew and were friendly with the hardcore anti-APA people. And a recommendation from Peter Payne, for example, one of the most famous environmental, pro-environment leaders, got me in the door to Andy Halloran, who was the Essex County judge and a real opponent of the APA. But the two men are friends.
Yet at some point during the formation of the APA, after it had gotten approval and was working, there was actually violence. A lot of people forget that there was violence and hostility. You know, your book does trace the fact that this was not easy. And here we go. We've got
Absolutely.
This set up in the Adirondacks now.
There was violence. There was a lot more threat than there was actual violence. There was a lot more really tough talk, threatening talk. And the actual violent acts that everyone remembers mostly took place in between 1989 and 1992. In the 1970s, when the Adirondack Park Agency was being created, most of the people who lived here either didn't know what was happening or didn't care. And by the time the private land plan was released for public comment at the end of 1972, really only a few full-time park residents understood that something very big was about to happen. And the law was passed 5 months later, so there really wasn't very much time for the local people to react.
When you look back at all of the people that you have talked to in crafting this book, who do you believe were the most influential individuals that led to the creation of the APA?
When you go back to the early 1950s, 20 years before the creation of the APA, the environmental movement was a very small group of people. And they were politically very much on the fringe. And there were several people who worked behind the scenes and built the movement over decades who are not very well known. One of my favorite interviews was a guy in Schenectady named Dave Newhouse, who was an official at the Adirondack Mountain Club. The Adirondack Mountain Club was a hiking club. They were apolitical, but they had 2,000 members and they all loved the Adirondacks. Dave Newhouse got religion for the environmental movement, and he wanted the Adirondack Mountain Club to start taking political positions. The president of the club said, no, we don't do that. But he had such high regard for Dave that he said, the Conservation Committee can do that if it wants to. And so Dave was off and running, and under his leadership, the Adirondack Mountain Club became one of the main voices for the environmental movement in the 60s in the Adirondacks.
Which people that you interviewed did you find to be the most interesting, and I will do air quotes, characters?
Oh, well, there were a lot of really interesting characters. Dave Newhouse's pal, Almy Coggeshall, was just a hilarious interview. These both men lived in Schenectady. They both worked at General Electric as engineers. And Almy was this very jolly man who told all kinds of funny stories, particularly about snowmobiles. In the early 1960s, Almy, he loved cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, being out in the woods in the winter where it was silent and, you know, beautiful. And he told me a story about how the first time he heard a snowmobile, he just lost his mind. And he went running after it, and he chased it down. He said, what the hell are you doing? because it was shattering the peace of his winter reverie. I'll go ahead and say this word on the radio, but at a meeting once where he was railing against snowmobiles, he became known as an anti-snowmobile voice. Somebody who sold snowmobiles came up and said, "Almy, can you ever say the word snowmobile without saying the word first?" And, so Almy was just hilarious.
How important do you think your interviews with these individuals have become, since many of them now have passed on?
Well, I don't know. My hope is that they will provide a record that people can go back to. What I learned as a journalist over the decades is that the paper records that are left behind from legislation and political movements really don't tell the most interesting stuff about what happened, because politics is about relationships between people, and personalities drive political change. And so in these interviews, I really tried to capture what the personalities were and how they interacted with each other and some of the things that didn't show up in the historic records. So my hope is that they have lasting value, and they certainly produced what I think is a pretty lively book.
You also are able to look at some of the local and regional people, and not just the more visible people, as I mentioned, the Rockefellers earlier, and their reaction to ideas, and some of the ideas that occurred 50 years ago that we've forgotten. We've forgotten 50 years on that people did think about making the Adirondacks a national park in the past.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in 1967, the Northway opened, an interstate highway up the east side of the Adirondacks, and everybody was thrilled with the idea that you could just point your Thunderbird north at 55, 60 miles an hour and not have any stoplights all the way from Albany to Montreal. And that was the modern way. People really wanted to get places in their cars. And in the 60s, national parks were all set up so that people could get to the scenic place in their cars and then go to the snack bar and have lunch. Hiking or being forever wild really wasn't part of that. And so in 1967, when Nelson Rockefeller's brother proposed that the Adirondacks become a national park, he thought he was proposing something that would benefit the people of the United States, because most of them wanted to use their cars to get wherever they needed to go. He really didn't know about the intense dedication that people in the Adirondacks had to the Forever Wild Clause and what that meant to people in New York State. And he ran into a brick wall.
Obviously, we consider the Adirondacks unique, particularly because of its mixture of public and private lands. Now, because of the way the APA regulates it, could it ever be replicated elsewhere?
I don't think the APA could be replicated elsewhere in the same way. The forces that created it 50 years ago are no longer present. Most notably, I think Americans in particular don't really trust top-down government solutions as much as they used to. So I don't really see it happening again in exactly the same way. But at the same time, landscape-level conservation, the idea of preserving entire bioregions and large unbroken forests, that is a crucial idea. That's something that's globally important as a way of controlling climate change. So while it can't happen again in precisely the same way, it needs to happen all over the world, and we need to find ways to do that.
Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
Earlier, we spoke about a group of potential workers known as STARS, but many companies already have employees that they think of as STARS, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
STAR employees are a boon to a company, but only if they pass on what they know to others. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Yamuna Babaraj, assistant professor of management, explores how to best integrate top talent.
Companies often depend on STAR employees to sustain a competitive advantage and even change their fortunes. STAR employees are top performers, serving as repositories of technical, industry, and firm knowledge, and have significant visibility in the external market, but they often change jobs and may take key members or customers with them when they depart. Consequently, less prepared companies suffer a severe blow when such talent leaves. My colleague and I explored ways in which companies can leverage the star performer capital and protect themselves against these situations by effectively integrating stars into their organizations. Current research shows star performers who collaborate with other employees or have a breadth of expertise in several areas contribute much more to the overall development of the organization's innovation than stars who rarely collaborate. When stars collaborate with other colleagues in innovative ways, the latter's new knowledge becomes part of the organizational memory, and the impact of a star's exit is felt less severely. The key to success for companies is to design their work structure, hiring, performance evaluations, cultural values, cultivating teams of excellence, adopting a non-star philosophy, and designing compensation and reward systems so that they favor knowledge sharing, collaboration, and a greater loyalty to the organization as a whole. By reducing dependence on such performers and investing in developing pools of distributed expertise, a star's departure can be viewed not as a company failure or crisis, but as an opportunity for the company to follow new research avenues that were not considered before and incentivize other employees to pursue new research directions.
That was Yamuna Babaraj of Widener University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.